Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Graduations all over, a spacewalk to repair Hubble, and a tragic U.S. military shooting of its own in Iraq. At Arizona State University's graduation, President Obama called for new values.
The elevation of appearance over substance, of celebrity over character, of short-term gains over lasting achievement, is precisely what your generation needs to help end.
In space, astronauts prepped here to repair an old friend.
I'm looking forward to seeing our old friend Hubble, the space telescope.
Yeah.
And seeing if it's aged at all. I know I have. A little gray in the mustache here.
And the father of Sergeant John Russell, who shot five fellow soldiers at a stress clinic outside Baghdad, said the Army broke his son.
They were stressed and they broke him. They ruined his life. They told him, you're an idiot. You don't belong in here. We're going to break you. We're going to get you out of here.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Where are we now on the economy, healthcare, new regs for Wall Street, a new commander for Afghanistan? What do you say about the president and the detainee abuse photos? About Pelosi, the Republicans, and torture? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor for the Wall Street Journal. He writes the Capital Journal column. Jerry, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Karen, and Jerry.
There is so much on our plate today. Let's just dive in straight away with Pelosi and the CIA. They've been very hot. At her press conference yesterday, she fought back against charges that she knew of and condoned waterboarding.
Techniques, including waterboarding, had already been employed, and that those briefing me in September 2002 gave me inaccurate and incomplete information. At the same time, the Bush administration, is exactly the same time, September of 2002, the fall of 2002. At the same time, the Bush administration was misleading the American people about the threat of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Were you lied to, she was asked. Yes, she said. Then today, NBC's Today Show, Senator Kit Bond, Republican of Missouri, vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, challenging Pelosi's claim that she was not told about waterboarding.
I have looked at the underlying materials, not only the records they kept, but the cables they sent out to the field, and from the what was apparently contemporaneous documents,
right.
It's clear that they did tell her.
Karen Tumulty, what should we make of this whole thing? It seems like 5 minutes ago the talk was about torture and who was responsible for it, and even whether or not there might be prosecutions of the Bush administration figures. Now it's Nancy Pelosi in the hot seat, and it's pretty hot.
It is. And I think what it tells us is that where President Obama wanted to sort of put this behind him, this story is going to continue going on through the summer, or at least into the summer. And I think that this question of, you know, whether someone should be prosecuted for all of this, or whether, as Nancy Pelosi has argued for, there should be some kind of truth commission, is not going to go away.
Jerry Seib, what does put an end to this then? How does this peter out? This fire just keeps roaring.
I don't know. I agree with Karen. I think the Obama White House strategy all along has been to air this out for a while, then put an end to it and move on. I mean, every step they've taken, you know, releasing the memos in the hopes that that would sort of quell things, but saying we don't want a truth commission, we don't want to prosecute people, then not releasing the photos that were discussed this week of prisoners under interrogation because of a fear that that would fan the flames more. They clearly don't want this. I can't imagine they're happy about the way the Pelosi thing gave the whole debate new life yesterday. And I don't think they or anybody else know how it's going to end now, because everything they've done up until this point to try to bring it to a close has not worked.
Jack, it's kind of a piece with the detainee abuse photos. I mean, it's one very big continent here. Let's listen to President Obama on Wednesday saying that he would resist releasing photos that his White House had earlier said they would, showing detainee abuse at the hands of American interrogators.
The individuals who were involved have been identified and appropriate actions have been taken. It's therefore my belief that the publication of these photos would not add any additional benefit to our understanding of what was carried out in the past by a small number of individuals.
Okay, Jack, there's a lot on the table. ACLU and others furious that the president won't release these. He's saying it will put our soldiers in jeopardy, that he was told that by Robert Gates and military commanders. And there's a whole range that goes all the way from Bush-era figures and charges of torture. We talked about Dick Cheney this week, to the president and these abuse photos, to Nancy Pelosi fighting over whether what she knew when she knew it, Jack.
Yes. Yeah, so on Pelosi, just to start there, Bob Graham, who was her opposite number in the Senate, Intelligence Committee, he has now said that in the same month in the fall of 2002, when Pelosi said she was not briefed about either waterboarding or enhanced interrogation techniques, that he, too, was not told about these
former
things.
Florida senator would have
that's
been one
right.
of the so-called Gang of Four, the little
that's
tiny
right,
number
that's right.
supposedly informed.
Right. So that's some corroboration for her, who knows what the real truth is. But on the photographs, I was disappointed. Many people were to hear Obama using the rotten apples rationale, where people have already been punished. He said, "Well, you know, let me just quote here from the Senate Armed Services report on this. They say the abuse can't simply be attributed to a few bad apples. Senior officials in the U.S. government solicited information on how to use aggressive techniques, redefine the law to create the appearance of legality, and authorize their use against detainees." And it's really it's depressing to hear the president who using this rationale when, in fact, we know that we have descriptions of Dom Rumsfeld saying, "Well, I stand 12 hours at a time. Why can't these people?"
Karen Tumulty, I hear that rationale, but the bigger one seemed to me to be, if we put these out there, it just makes more trouble for American soldiers. I mean, the force multiplier of the Abu Ghraib images has often been discussed. Of course, it's the abuse in the first place is the core problem. But what about the argument that this just makes more headwind for American efforts that face plenty of headwind already in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I guess the argument is that, you know, given that the memos have already been released, it is unclear what these photos would actually add to our knowledge of what took place. But they would become, you know, they would become a marketing tool for al-Qaeda.
But it's funny that Obama's taking the heat here. I mean, some want it out, some don't want it out. But he was not president when these things happened. And one of his first acts was to say no more of this kind of coercive interrogation or torture.
But he also did reverse himself on the question of these photographs, and I think that is the issue. And by the way, it's far from clear whether the administration is going to win this battle in court.
Think they may still be out there on Memorial Day weekend?
That's entirely possible.
Let's get a call from Dubuque, Iowa, and Tony. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Well, you know, this take on Mrs. Pelosi. I believe her, and I don't believe her. The reason I don't believe her is she should have known, okay? That's why she's the lead senator. Now, as far as the CIA, I don't believe anything that comes out of that place, okay? I can't. They're secretive. Why would they tell anybody the truth, okay? That's just my opinion.
Tony, let us pick it up. Jerry Seibel, Speaker of the House, really twisting in the wind this week. You can see the kind of agony on Nancy Pelosi's face about what to say and how to say it. What is the bind she's in here, Jerry?
There are two binds that she's in. One is that she is sort of out there with an assertion that she was misled, and now it's become more overt that she was lied to by the CIA. And the struggle is to prove that, which is probably in these circumstances almost impossible to do. The other, though, and this is probably equally troubling in the long run for her, is that the question will be, well, if this was such an outrageous practice, why didn't you stop it? Because in a way, this question of whether she was or wasn't told in September of 2002 is a bit of a tempest in a teapot, because mm-hmm. now she even acknowledges that she found out indirectly through an aide 5 months later in February that they were indeed waterboarding suspects. And so the question from her own allies is going to be, well, why didn't you do something to stop it then? Leave aside the question of whether you knew in September or 5 months later in February. What then? What happened? And her argument is, I was powerless to do anything about it. That's an awkward position for somebody to take when they've made such a case that this should have been stopped and everything should have been done to stop it before now.
And by the way, there is no evidence here that she did say anything. Even, I mean, her story is, well, I was informed that this was a possibility in 2002. Well, you know, there were members of Congress who did protest, who wrote letters. There's no evidence that Nancy Pelosi, even if she, you know, was informed that this was something they were thinking about, that this was anything she tried to stop.
But does that mean, Jack, let's say, I mean, it was tough then. People were put in a box. They were told not to speak publicly. Only a very few were told about this. Could she, should she have stopped it? Or even if she failed to, is the focus in the right place here?
I don't think the focus is on the right place, and I'm not sure what she could have done. Senator Rockefeller was in a similar position. He had to write a memo in, I believe, longhand for his files, giving his reservations about similar matters, because he couldn't even discuss it with his staff. You know, this business of congressional oversight of the CIA in this way, really it's a way of co-opting Congress. If they can't tell their staff, if they can't, by reasons of secrecy, protest, all they can do is at that meeting raise questions and say, do we really need to do that? Now, we don't know whether she did that or not. But it's this whole business of how to oversee the CIA, I think, is something we have to work out in a much better way than has been done.
And, of course, the screws were really on in the aftermath of 9/11. People were really boxed in. Nevertheless, there's Nancy Pelosi twisting in the wind. And the whole issue, the whole Bush-era bag of issues around interrogation unresolved in the Obama era. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Chrysler dealerships go down, GM to follow. Obama will restart Getmo trials and renege on detainee photos. We've got healthcare moves and a new commander for Afghanistan with Time Magazine's national political correspondent Karen Tumulty joining us from New York. Gerald Seib of the Wall Street Journal, assistant managing editor, executive Washington editor there, writes the paper's weekly Capital Journal column. Jack Beatty's here as well. Let's go right to Joanne in Columbia, South Carolina. Joanne, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, what do you know?
Not much, you. I had to say that. I actually think this whole thing with Pelosi is a non-story. She signed or pledged an oath not to say anything about any information she was being given that was classified. So if she knew, when she knew, it's a non-story. We had a Republican president, Republican Senate, Republican House. What power did she really have to do anything? I just think the whole thing's a non-story, and it's basically the Republicans saying, oops, we made a mistake. We got to blame someone else.
We've got a lot to look at here, but let's give it one more swing. Gerald Seib, could she have done something then? Karen says, well, others made a little more noise, but it wasn't very public noise. Could Nancy Pelosi in 2002 or 2003 have somehow stepped out of this cone of silence she was told to be in and changed this policy?
Well, I agree with Jack. It would have been difficult. There are not a lot of good options for somebody who's in the position she was in at that point. But to me, that just raises the question of why she has made such a public spectacle of this argument. I mean, whether she knew or whether she didn't know, it wasn't her policy. It wasn't the Democrats' policy. And there probably isn't a lot she could have done about it. So I'm not sure what the point of the argument is either. I sort of agree with Joanne a little bit. But then if that's the case, I'm not sure what the point of the speaker going out and doing a press conference yesterday to sort of replow this ground was really supposed to be. All it's done is kept a fairly circular argument alive.
Karen, isn't it because the Republicans are themselves pushing this as a kind of a counter story to the story of, what kind of investigation should be done of torture in the Bush years?
Yeah, I mean, what the Republicans are saying is, well, you know, the Democrats knew about it, and here's the evidence, which, again, I do think that, you know, had Nancy Pelosi just said, look, I did know and my hands were tied, that would have been a far simpler argument to make than this kind of back and forth that she's gotten into now.
I want to turn, if we can, President Obama says no detainee photos out there, please, because it will hurt the troops, and the troops are active in Iraq and Afghanistan. And big news on the Afghan front this week with one commander out and a new one coming in. Here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates saying he's changing command, appointing new top commander Stanley McChrystal. He was asked to explain his rationale.
with agreement on a new strategy and a new mission and a new national approach, an international approach in Afghanistan, that if there were to be a change, this is the right time to make the change, at a time when we are at the beginning of the implementation of a new strategy. And it is in that context that I emphasize that the focus here is simply on getting fresh thinking, fresh eyes on the problem.
Fresh thinking, fresh eyes, always good. But Jerry Saab, how should we interpret what's going on here? It's a pretty abrupt change. General McKinnon was not there that long. He had asked for more troops. Of course, more are coming, but seems to indicate a bigger shift than that. What's going on, Jerry?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a pretty tacit acknowledgement that things are sliding backwards in Afghanistan, not moving forward in terms of the U.S. military effort and the establishment of stability and a strong central government. So it's a pretty candid acknowledgement that things are, the trend line's not good. That's the first thing. The second thing is it is a sign that there has been a struggle underway that's now been resolved in the Pentagon between essentially kind of an old school way of thinking about this conflict, which General McKernan, who's now been relieved of his job, personified in many ways, and a kind of new wave counterinsurgency kind of thinking, which General McChrystal, who comes from the Special Operations Command, represents. This is going to be a less conventional, more Iraq surge-like operation in Afghanistan that's going to probably involve less frontal assaults on the Taliban and more organic troops on the ground, infiltration of Taliban strongholds, a different kind of warfare. And I think what Bob Gates was saying was you can't do that unless you make a wholesale change, and that's what this represents.
Kieran Tumulty, at the same time, there's a clock ticking here. I'm reading a Time story saying that David Obey, Congressman out of Wisconsin, Appropriations Committee Chairman, is warning that Democrats will give the Obama administration just one more year to get a handle on the military situation before they start losing patience, whatever that means. I mean, maybe they don't have forever, even from their own party here.
I think that's right, and we saw a big signal when we saw, I believe it was 51 House Democrats voted against the money for Afghanistan. And I think there is a big, there's a lot of impatience on the part of the Democrats, and I think, too, there is a demand that the president more carefully define what precisely the mission in Afghanistan is, because there's fear, and certainly part of the debate in the Pentagon was that the military is going from, you know, its traditional role to getting more into occupation and nation building, even by, you know, using these tactics that General McChrystal was so successful with in Iraq. So I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Barack Obama to explain a little more clearly just what the mission in Afghanistan is.
Jack, the cauldron getting just hotter and tighter here. The economy, a week ago we were talking about how it looked like turning the corner. Just 1 week later, maybe not so clear. And then from Iraq to Afghanistan to policy on detainees and all the rest, Barack Obama facing anything but sort of a clear skies here.
Oh, a sea of troubles, that's for sure. But, you know, in Afghanistan, let's hope that these new tactics that General McChrystal wants to use do not include or subordinate the use of drone airstrikes. There have been 16 of these in this year alone compared to 38 in all of last year. In today's New York Times, the front page story, if you can read about what happened to this village where perhaps over 100 people were killed by a drone, women, children.
Western Afghanistan.
Yes. Mm-hmm. If you can read that and think that this is a tactic that's sustainable, or that a military commitment that rests on such tactics is sustainable, then I think you're kidding yourself. You know, it has the look of defeat. I mean, how can you do this to people and expect them to support you or their government?
Jerry, what do you expect from General McChrystal to bring in? He's got quite a reputation. What does it signal about the likely direction of the Afghan effort?
Well, probably smaller, small unit operations on the ground, fanning out into villages, getting on the ground with people in Afghanistan as they did in Iraq. And I think the key here is attempts to break apart the Taliban, to find elements within the Taliban that the U.S. decides are open to working with American forces who can be splintered away from the hardcore elements of the Taliban, finding those people, finding the local warlords that control those people, wooing them over, and doing that in a very sort of intense face-to-face way on the ground. That's what I suspect we're about to see in Afghanistan. I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of effort invested in trying to create a kind of conventional central government that has control over the whole country. I think most people think that's probably a bridge too far. Much more important to break apart the Taliban and peel away and pull over to your side elements of it that can actually work with rather than against the U.S. and the Afghan central government such as it is.
Such as it is. Let's take a turn here and go to Jason, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi. And the subject I'd like to comment on is whether the insurance industry can be trusted to voluntarily contain its costs.
The healthcare industry, yes.
Yes, and then one two-letter word I would say, ha. They haven't to date from the beginning of the Clinton administration to the present, and there's always going to be a conflict where we, the public, will lose and if they are beholden to their shareholders, and every reduction in cost and care is a benefit to the company. It hasn't worked. I mean, I've been a healthcare provider for over 25 years, a direct provider in all kinds of settings, and it's painful to me to see the loss of quality care because of financial problems. And if I mention that to a patient, I am chastised by people higher up.
Jason, let us pick it straight up because it's another huge continent right in the middle of the news this week. Karen Templeton, you've been writing a lot about it. The healthcare industry right there in the White House promising, what, $2 trillion in cost reduction over 10 years. What's going on with that? How does it relate to Obama's healthcare effort? Is it promising or not? And what about Jason says, ha, that's his response.
Well, here's what actually happened. The White House got this supposed commitment from the healthcare industry that they were going to take cost containment efforts that would cut $2 trillion off their costs over the next 10 years. So the White House on Sunday, slowest news day of the week, has this big briefing for healthcare reporters and announces that this is, you know, even though it's not enforceable, and quite frankly, it's not even trackable. You can't even figure out whether these people are living up to this commitment. But they announce this like this is this gigantically important development. The next day, the president comes forward and declares it historic. I think there was a lot of reason to be skeptical about it from the beginning. But what it was is essentially the Obama White House and the healthcare industry gave each other one day of mutually beneficial public relations. And today come the stories that say, wait a minute, you know, the healthcare people are saying, we didn't commit to any of this. Well, the fact is, I think the healthcare industry has decided that, you know what, reform may actually happen this year. And if it does, we want to be at the table. And the Obama White House realizes that having them at the table, it makes it more likely that the whole thing does happen this year. So as much as anything, I think it was a political gesture and an attempt to sort of create the appearance of momentum where perhaps there wasn't so much.
Maybe a gesture, but Jerry Seib, you're writing this week that in this week, the odds of healthcare reform overhaul happening headed up, maybe a lot.
Well, yeah, but I think for the reason that Karen just cited, what this event was really a signal that the health industry was saying, we want to be in the room and at the table participating rather than outside the room shouting about it and trying to get people to storm the room. That's the big change. I think the specifics of the quote-unquote commitment to cut costs are very illusory and probably not to be taken too seriously. Although I will say that, you know, the one thing that this effort also showed is that people in the health insurance industry and other providers to some extent really fear that the cost increases are ultimately going to lose this market for them, because if they don't do something to reform the system, get costs under control, they know the alternative down the line is a single-payer government health care program that wipes out their industry. So do they have an incentive to control costs? Yeah. Should you be skeptical that they know how to do that? Yeah, sure. But the handwriting is on the wall to some extent. And they see that, and that's one of the reasons they're doing this.
Although, Tom, I also think it's worth mentioning, too, that I think there was a real shift that has been happening that became incredibly clear this week, which is that this debate and the marketing of healthcare reform is now all about cost control. It's not about, you know, I mean, the president mentioned universal coverage, but that was, you know, sort of almost practically an afterthought
in his state. 47 million uncovered Americans, not much spoken of here.
Right. I think there has been a calculation made that you know, that by emphasizing cost containment, that this whole program is going to be a lot more easy to sell politically.
And maybe he's right. We'll talk about it. The president was in the Southwest this week, Arizona, is talking to the graduates in Arizona, but also in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, for a town hall meeting on Thursday, talking there about health care reform. Here's a little bit from that town hall meeting where he said a single-payer system would be best in an ideal world, but America can't totally shift course right now, so he says, to compromise.
The only problem is that we're not starting from scratch. We have historically a tradition of employer-based health care. And although there are a lot of people who are not satisfied with their health care, the truth is that the vast majority of people currently get health care from their employers, and you've got this system that's already in place. We don't want a huge disruption as we go into health care reform where suddenly we're trying to completely reinvent one-sixth of the economy.
Karen, the president says we don't want a huge disruption, but people seem to agree pretty widely these days we need a huge reform. So what does that reform look like? What's the likely form emerging from all these, you know, with all these political currents rushing around?
Well, the big question right now politically, and I don't think it matters as much as substantively, but politically the big question is whether whatever emergence has is what is being called a public option, which means that if you aren't one of these people who's satisfied with what you've got or you don't have any coverage at all, you would have the option of buying coverage through a government-financed plan very much like Medicare. This is something that the insurance companies are saying is an absolute deal breaker as far as they're concerned, that, you know, there are estimates that 130 million or more Americans given that option would take it, which would essentially destroy their business model. And, you know, a lot of people see it as kind of the first step toward a single payer system. So, you know, the one question is whether that stays in the health care plan. And if I had to bet on it right now, I would say it probably doesn't, at least not in a form that is truly like Medicare.
The president was talking. Yes, please, Jack.
I was going to say, and yet if it isn't in that form, there's nothing there that will work toward cost control. Because, of course, the prospect of this public plan will induce massive efficiencies in the private market to match the lower public cost. Why will the public plan be cheaper? Because the overhead for Medicare is 3% at most. The administrative overhead in private insurance is 14 or 15%. That overhead is paid for in the premiums that people pay. And so, yeah, they're terribly afraid of it. It isn't only that the public plan is necessary to get insurance for people who don't have it. The public plan is necessary to drive down costs throughout the system.
Jerry Seib, I'm already seeing television ads against health care reform or warnings it'll make it like Europe or Canada where you can't get X, Y, and Z. And I found myself wondering, are the same people coming to the White House and saying we're going to cut costs and work with you, putting up these ads, trying to block particular kinds of reform?
Not really. I mean, this is one of the big differences between today's environment and the one that we saw in the 90s when the Clinton administration tried to do big health reform, which was at that point you had a fairly unified health industry opposition to the overhaul that was being attempted. The insurance companies sponsored the ads then that basically killed the Harry and Louise ads that killed the health reform overhaul in the 1990s. Now they're in the White House with another Democratic president standing shoulder to shoulder, essentially saying, we want to work with you on this. So you have clear opposition, Republican Party opposition, economic conservative opposition, but the health care industry has moved to a different place, and so that's different.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. A journalist freed, a California beauty queen, complains. Dealerships on the chopping block this week. Roxana Sabari, Iranian American journalist imprisoned in Tehran, was released.
I want to thank all the people all over the world, which I'm just finding out about, really, who, whether they knew me or not, helped me and my family during this period.
Miss California, Carrie Prejean, defended her right to her crown and to speak her mind on same-sex marriage.
I exercised my freedom of speech, and I was punished for doing so. This should not happen in America.
Chrysler and GM announced dealership closings. Here's one unhappy dealer's take.
To wipe out 25% of the Chrysler dealers and take another 40% of the GM dealers and think that it's going to increase sales? Come on.
He doesn't believe it. Karen Tumbledy is with us from Time Magazine. Jerry Seib from The Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Let's get a call from Alice in Buffalo, New York. Alice, you're on the air.
Thank you. I have an opinion on all those subjects, but I will stick to health care.
Okay.
First of all, I'm dismayed by the lack of trust in each other all the way through. But I do believe the health care people can do a lot to save money and will do it. I believe in a degree of self-regulation. And I think parents should, or the elderly patients should have the right to choose between a $2,000 PEP scan and taking their chances. And I have a personal sample of that.
Alice, it sounds like you're ready to make choices on health care. Let's get one more here from, thank you for your call, Mark in Hilton Head, South Carolina. You're on the air.
How are you doing, sir?
All right.
I own a business. Yes, hello.
Hi.
I own a business in South Carolina, and I have a lot of clients that are from other countries. And I have one client that was in last week from Toronto, and she was telling me that she's kind of tired of them being bad-mouthed all the time. And she gave me 2 points that were interesting. She said, go on a Google search and try to find any other country that has a group of people demanding our health care model because they don't want it. And number two, she said, for every person in Canada that waits for an operation, there's probably 1,000 here that just get told, no, you can't have the operation.
So go on Google and look for somebody who wants to copy the American model, and you won't get a lot of replies. She may be right. Jerry, Jack, Karen, let's listen to President Obama here for just a second again in New Mexico. I want to try and figure out what he's actually pushing for. He's talking about, in this clip, tape, getting something passed this year.
There are folks in Congress who are doing terrific work. They're working hard. They've been having a series of hearings. I'm confident that both the House and the Senate are going to produce a bill before the August recess. And it may not have everything I want in there or everything you want in there, but it'll be a vast improvement over what we currently have. We'll then have to reconcile the two bills, but I'm confident that we are going to get health care reform this year and start putting us on a path that's sustainable over the long term.
It's never happened before. Karen, you say this kind of talk comes around like cicadas every 17 years. There's the president talking big in New Mexico. So a bill on the table by August recess and through this year. Do you believe it? And what might it actually look like?
Well, I tell you, this, you know, it's those of us who've been through this before have to be skeptical just because we've been through this before. But here's the one thing that if I had to watch, this thing's going to have 1,000 moving parts, but if I had to watch one piece to try and figure out if this is likely to happen, it would be the question of how do you pay for it? This bill is going to have to pass under very, very strict budget rules where it has, whatever they do, has to pay for itself in a very short period of time. And the president's right. They did a lot. They've done a lot of hearings. The one this week focused on where do you find the money? And the one place that all the experts who were called up in front of the Senate Finance Committee agreed that you could find this money is if you started taxing health care benefits that are now provided to workers tax-free by their employers.
That was John McCain's idea in the campaign, wasn't it?
It was, and it was roundly criticized by Barack Obama. But the, you know, the problem is, if you're looking for the money, that is pretty much the only place you're going to find enough.
And where do these big new costs come from? What exactly costs so much money in the reforms that are contemplated, Karen?
Well, the biggest cost is covering 47 million people who don't have coverage, and that requires paying for their coverage or giving them subsidies where they can go out and buy it themselves. But you would also have enormous upfront investments in things like medical record keeping so that hospitals could keep track of who's getting what kind of treatment. And really a lot of other investments along those lines, a lot of investment in something called comparative effectiveness, which is a lot more study of what kinds of treatments and drugs work better than what other kinds of treatments and drugs, because there are estimates that as much $500 to $700 billion out of what is spent in this country every year on healthcare, that's, you know, a third to a quarter of the whole total, is spent on treatments that are not effective and that could, in fact, be hurting you.
Jerry Seib, I mean, those things sound big, but we hear big things, as Karen says, we have heard for over many years on healthcare. They can sound kind of pie in the sky. Do you see something this year? And if so, what's the basic structure of what you think Obama might push through?
Well, there's an interesting thing that you might have noticed here, which is that though people try to talk about it, there is no Obama health reform plan. There is an attempt by a Democratic Congress to write such a plan, but it's at this point impossible to say, here's what the Obama plan is, and that's quite by design. The administration wants to steer and prod Congress into writing a health reform without putting one on the table for itself. And what the president has done instead is put out very general principles that whatever is done has to reduce costs, whatever is done has to allow people to keep the health care that they have now, and it has to eventually cover everybody. But that's extremely broad. And so right now I find it very hard to say this looks like it could pass, this doesn't look like it could pass, because I don't know what it is yet, and I don't think we will know for a while yet, for another month or so. I do know that I think Karen's point is right, that the key is how do you pay for it. And this is what's tricky about health reform right now, is that Jack is right that the best way to save money in the entire system is to get everybody covered so that people aren't coming in through the back door in very inefficient ways and getting health care on the backs of others and through emergency rooms. You got to get everybody covered to save money. That's the irony of it. But it costs money to cover everybody in the short run. How do they make those numbers add up, and where does the money come from? That's the key question.
That sounds pretty broad for something that's supposed to be, you know, a bill on the table by the August recess and passed this year. Deb in Lebanon, Connecticut. You're on the air, Deb.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Yeah. I'll try to make it very quickly. I am 56 years old. My husband is 58 years old. He lost his job in September. We lost our health care because he doesn't have a job. I don't work except for part-time. We have no money to pay for health care. Most of the people, the pundits, and I say that in a nice way, who talk about the problems and the issues with health care probably are covered by some sort of health care. I know Congress certainly is.
Right.
And I just don't think enough weight is being given to the absolute terror of people in my situation.
Deb, you make the point. You make it vividly, and let us pick it straight up. Jack Deb is right on this. Everybody debating this in Washington has health coverage if they've got a crisis.
I just say, Tom? I mean, my most recent cover story in Time magazine was about how this very subject has affected my family, which is, you know, my brother's getting suddenly very sick.
So we talked about it with you for an hour. and no question, your brother didn't have it. But then many who are having it do. I think all Deb is saying is, like your brother, let's keep in mind those who just off stage are terrified. Jack, you can hear in Deb's voice by what they're facing.
Well, it's harrowing, and I'm very sorry to hear it about her and her husband. And, you know, this is a primary form of insecurity that our population has had for a long time that they do not have in Europe. And, you know, people run down the European system as non-competitive and so on. Many, many Americans would swap it to have a system where they didn't have to worry about something like health. Is health care a right or is it a privilege? In our system, it has been a privilege. And in the economy we have evolved of low-wage service jobs and insecure employment, the employer-based system has been breaking down around us, breaking down because of coverage and breaking down because of cost. And yeah, the president is right. In an ideal world, we would do single payer. But my fear is that that what they're going to put together will be a bastard version, something that'll have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and cost will explode and coverage will not get out there. And, you know, the president had, as I understand it, the bill that they are shaping cannot be filibustered. And that gives him a tremendous opportunity, gives the Democrats a tremendous opportunity to reach for the maximum, which I think involves that public plan. And if they don't use that authority, they will have lost I think, the potential of the moment.
I want to ask about that, but let me get a call here from Nashville first. Bill in Tennessee, you're on the air.
Tom, hello? Thanks. Certainly. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very fascinating discussion. I have 3 points to make.
Mm.
The way to finance a health care program is to take it out of the insurance companies, who have an overhead of 11 to 14%, which I think Karen Tumbledy just mentioned, mm-hmm. versus 3% in Medicare. There's billions of dollars right there to finance the health care for 47 million people.
Mm-hmm.
Second point is free market for health insurance doesn't work. That's why we've got 47 million people that are uncovered.
Mm.
They can't afford it. Their employers don't offer it. Their employers are just unable to afford it themselves.
Yep.
The third point is that rationing already exists. Mm. We need a public debate on the standards for rationing health care, like AIDS, medical condition, whatever.
Bill, I'll put you right on the panel to figure it out. That's some pretty good, clear thinking. Jerry Seib, do you see people ready to rally around something new?
I do think there is a much greater desire and willingness to take some chances here to try some new things. But I do also think there are limits to that. And I think there's a reason that the White House says over and over again, we're not going to force anybody to give up what they already have. Because unhappy as people who are covered may be with the kind of coverage they have, there is great fear of the unknown. And that's a real issue here. I would also note that the word that the caller just used, rationing, is the one that the Republicans are going to be using over and over and over again in the next 3 or 4 months, because I think they believe that in the public's mind, that is the great downside risk of anything that resembles a government-run health program, that government bureaucrats will ration your health care. That is the vision that Republicans are going to use to try to stop a Democratic kind of reform from taking place.
But that
place.
Puts us right back to 1992, and as Bill says, in effect, we have rationing already.
Well, except that, again, I go back to the fact that the public desire to take a chance is higher now than it was in 1992 and 1993, mm-hmm. and the industry's realization that they probably ought to get in front of this train rather than try to disrail this train is quite different than it was in the 90s, because there is an unsustainable character to all the trend lines that you see now in the healthcare system.
Karen, you had a really interesting little bit of reporting on Obama sitting down with Republicans not long ago and saying, "Look, let's dicker, let's do a deal here." And he put a proposal on the table. You report said he was willing to curb malpractice awards, which the GOP has asked for a long time. What would they put on the table in return to help get an agreement on health care? And he got nothing, you write, from them.
Exactly.
Are there the makings of a deal here or not?
Right. This was at a meeting in the White House a couple of weeks ago in the cabinet room, and there was apparently dead silence on the Republican side of the table. And that has been a really interesting thing to watch through all of this because, you know, as Jerry says, it's clear that the insurance industry wants to be part of shaping whatever happens. The hospital industry wants to be there. The doctors want to be there. But we really haven't gotten from the Republicans, you know, what it is they would like to see. And, you know, I think that on the one hand, they understand that they can't be for nothing. They can't be for the status quo. But they are sort of refusing to, with some exceptions. I mean, they're, you know, Senator Grassley has been working very closely with Senator Baucus in the Finance Committee. But outside of a very few Republicans like that, they just seem to be, you know, almost trying to pretend that this conversation isn't even happening.
And yet it's very, very much on.
Yeah.
Jack?
Yeah, I was going to say, and I think they recognize the political reality. You know, in 2004, Bill Kristol wrote a memo to the Republicans, and he said, look, Don't do anything. Don't make any gesture toward Clinton Care at all. Why? Not because it would could fail, but because it could succeed. And if it did succeed, you'd have a new Social Security. You'd have a new Democratic program that millions of Americans, like our caller from Connecticut, would say, my God, the Democratic Party delivered this to me, and you'd have another generation of Democratic victories. The Republicans understand that. They don't want it to pass for political reasons.
Let's get one more call from Detroit. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a real quick comment about the whole Miss California thing.
Okay.
She is entitled as an American to her opinion, and her opinion is as valid as the next person. On the other hand, every other American is entitled to call her opinion into question and, frankly, to mock her for it. Her whole crying about, oh, I'm being attacked for expressing my opinion, and you know what? That's the price you pay for having free speech. If she's allowed to say that, I'm allowed to make fun of her for it.
No sympathy for the beauty queen out of Detroit, but it is interesting, Jack. Miss California, with all her photographs and everything else, kind of put it back on the table again. Gay marriage is moving. It is moving in this country, but it doesn't mean it's a culturally resolved issue. She made clear, and she said, look, the president is not for it. The secretary, Hillary Clinton's not for it. Why are you jumping on me?
Pretty good argument. But up here in New Hampshire, by the way, you say it's moving. Our governor is going to be signing a bill probably next week that will legalize gay marriage here. What's that, the sixth state in a row? So, yes, it does have now political momentum, and this too was something done through the legislature, not through courts.
Jerry Seib, we just got half a minute. A last thought. A week ago, we were talking about the economy turning around. Is that still the buzz, or are we in the hiccup here?
Well, we're in a hiccup, but there are going to be a lot of hiccups. I think that overall the picture is still slowly getting brighter, but slowly is the key word, and a few things this week that didn't look quite so bright. But there are going to be weeks like this all through this year. The recovery is slow.
Well, let us pray it's slow and not that, what do they call it, false bottom or whatever it may be. Gerald Seib, it's always great to have you with the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for being with us today, Jerry.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
And Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Always wonderful to have you as well, Karen. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend up there in evolving New Hampshire.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.